Ciara O'Donnell, Director of the Professional Development Service for Teachers. Thank you very much for a really, really engaging hour there. So much of it resonated with me and the work we do on the team as teacher educators. And I suppose the challenges we're having in convincing perhaps policy of what we're finding and what we find works for the practitioners in the classroom. In particular, I'd like to comment, I suppose, on your the discourse there about the implementation dip when people are trying to try something out. And we are finding that there is a real fear there amongst teachers. What we're hearing is, we would like to, but we don't feel we have the time and we don't have the luxury of trying something out that may ultimately put our students on the back foot or that may look us make us like as if we are falling in our duties or whatever. So there's a huge attitudinal thing to, I think, to manage there. Being a professional, and Andy Hargreaves would say that, you again touched on it here, the whole definition of a professional moving now from being associated with having a status or expertise to actually being somebody who can be discerning and can have discretion to try something, even if it means, like you said, failing and sharpening the saw and doing it again. So really to revisit, I suppose, the definition of what being a professional is. It is about experimenting. It is about making mistakes. It is about learning lessons. And it is about refining your craft as a professional. So just want to thank you very much for raising that today. Thank you.
Marie Parker Jenkins, University of Limerick. I enjoyed your talk enormously, beautifully paced and a very good selection of materials to support it. I'd like to build on the last point though, and this issue of being prepared to take risks and that failure is not an option sometimes in our field. In the sense, we design a course, a program, etc., to recruit. We've brought in a team. We can't afford almost not to recruit or to fail. It's a lovely concept. It's a concept for children as well, actually, that we don't use enough. But I was going to ask you, from your own experience, have you seen examples of failure where, not that it has the potential to be better, because it can always be improved upon, but that there has been an environment where it's possible. For example, we've come through a recession where there are financial imperatives and people work very hard to get through that. So being a risk-taking organisational culture at that point would not have been particularly pertinent. It might have been very brave, but probably we weren't ready for that, many of us. But in your own experience, particularly given the scope and scale of what you've alluded to, have you got examples of where that has been adverse, but not necessarily with, again, pointing, building on the last point, there has been collateral damage, shall we say?
These are really, difficult questions. They're not easy questions. The first thing I'd like to say is that policymakers get their latest policy from local practice. So the people, if there's going to be new ideas and development, then policymakers will take examples often from practice that's already out there that might be a bit innovative. So it's not like there's policy and it's fixed and nobody can innovate. It's that, policymakers are also desperate for new ideas. And so I want to encourage local attempts to change things. I think you're absolutely spot on. Previous speakers, absolutely spot on. There is, I didn't talk much about it, but I put on my slide that there is a survival mentality now. We've created, through our accountability systems, frightened systems. And I don't think we've really researched that, actually. I've got a doctoral student who's currently spent, she's just finished writing up now, but she spent a year sitting in a primary classroom. And the data she has is dynamite, because it shows exactly what you're talking about. It shows that children don't move in school, that in a 35-minute PE lesson, they move for about 5 minutes. that they spend most of their lives sitting on a carpet, that the most common position for children is this, and that this is happening along with a rhetoric of learning power and learning and so on and so forth. So I actually think we have a duty to show that. I think that's what research is about, actually. And to start those debates of, if you want to do this, is this the best way to do it? But if you are trying to bring about change, I think you have to go with the level of risk you can bear. Otherwise, it just becomes another pressure on you. Oh my God, I've got to go and innovate now as well. So I do think it is possible to take risks without collapsing. No, I don't actually know. I do actually know of large-scale policies that have been disastrous, that have been introduced without taking account of that process I described. So that process is not about going from naught to policy. That process is going from idea to a little bit of practice, to collecting some evidence, to a bit more practice, a bit more practice, and a bit more evidence. And it's about changing as you go along, if that's what your intention is. So that, I think, is the dangerous thing, is not to go in an incremental way to develop an innovation. I'm not sure I've answered your question. Have I answered your question?
In many countries, we've seen evidence of where it hasn't worked. But on an individual or an institutional level within a department, risk-taking, particularly during economic downturns, where there's been huge expectations and accountability to recruit students, for example, the idea of working on a program and introducing it must recruit, really. The ideal because it needs to recruit and offset perhaps loss in other programs, because certain subjects and weight and programs become popular or not. And so that aversion to risk would be quite high, because a lot of effort may have been put into it, and expectations. So I think that it's a great idea of innovation, and I think we've got a lot from this in thinking, but it's that part there. If you launched a program, and people have examples, no doubt, and it didn't recruit, at least for the first year or two, it's really been a difficult experience to go through. That's the level at which I was actually thinking of.
No, I think that's right, and I'm not advocating have a great idea and jump off the bridge. I'm actually advocating have a great idea and start to build practice and collect bits of evidence as you go along. So before I were to launch a program, a brand new program, I'd want to do some other stuff. You know, I'd want to see, is this attractive to applicants? Is it, am I going to work with young people and so on and so forth? So I don't think trying to do something innovative is about being careless of, or reckless. Reckless is a better word. I think it is about risk-taking, but it's about measuring. I think I do see schools that are highly innovative, and I see head teachers who are confident, but that's not the norm. It takes a very confident head teacher to say, you know, I am actually going to risk this. I once sat and watched a head teacher wear an Ofsted inspector on that side of the table, and the Ofsted inspector said, can I have your observations, please? And he said, certainly. And he passed over the peer observations they did in this school that were part of staff development. And the Ofsted inspector said, no, pushed it back and said, no, I want your your observations, he said. Those are my observations. This went on for quite a while. But in the end, the head teacher was so firm and convinced, and, you know, that he could go with that. Many head teachers I know couldn't. They would be frightened of doing that. They'd be frightened of being marked down. And the consequences of that are profound. So what can we do about that? I think we can just do what we're doing now, which is talk about it, keep researching it, keep having the debate, keep making the case. And I do think that has an impact, actually. I don't think keeping quiet is the way forward. Sorry, we've taken a long time with that.
Time for a couple more questions. I think there's one over here, Trish.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Richard Millwood from Trinity. My life has been about large-scale action research and even rather perversely, large-scale action research to encourage small-scale action research. And so that term, action research, I'd love to hear what you, how would you contrast it with this speech you've made? How would it fit to the
I actually
debate?
Think it's what I'm talking about. So
good. That's why I'm glad you said that.
So I'll go back to Kazakhstan as an example. One of the basic problems the reform had was that it was based on a notion of professional development around collaboration. And in fact, when we started to work there, we discovered the teachers didn't know how to do that. And actually, one of the things I haven't talked about is the coherence of the system. So one of the reasons the teachers didn't know how to do that was that all the systems that had been put in place to motivate teachers were individual and competitive. So, you know, portfolio presentation, and if you did really well, you got a salary increase. So why would you share your idea with the person next to you? And so we introduced action research actually as a way of dealing with that. And I think it's had an amazing impact. And it's stuck. And they have built communities and they built networks around schools. So I think action research has all those elements, but that it has to be slow and it requires a great deal of facilitation. But you know that already.
Time for one final comment or question from Connor.
Okay, thanks very much. Again, an extraordinary talk. Thank you very much for that. Can I ask you for your thoughts, please, on the darker side of lobbying and change, the question of the expertocracy, as it's been put by, you know, Sotiria Greg and so on, the idea that the think tanks and the pressure groups and, you know, those who come from very, very committed and convinced views, you know, act as small-scale pressure points to get at the ministers and the policymakers. I mean, what's your thoughts on that and how do we deal with it?
I think it's absolutely real. And the bit I haven't talked about is the need for stability in order to innovate. So I am not talking about change. I am not talking about constant change. In fact, what I was trying to say with that hype cycle is that I think we're in constant change. We're not in real innovation. We're not seeing things through. We're not creating new ideas, researching them, and following them through that dip. I have seen, I've actually sat in a room where, I sat in a room with a discussion about issues in Parliament where I've watched lobby groups represented by one person dominate over the evidence of, you know, groups of people who had worked in that area for years. It is part of our landscape. And, you just need to read Stephen Ball, really, don't you? And see the connections. I'll just tell you one final story, which I shouldn't tell you because it'll give all the worst stereotypes of Cambridge in this story. So I was sat at a college dinner. Now, as Connor will know and others may know, if you go to a college dinner, it's not exactly a modern affair. You know, you sit there probably in a gown and you have your dinner and they pass the port and all those things. But I was listening to the after-dinner speaker, who was a young female academic who was working on the Genome Project. And she was telling her story, that part of the reason for this dinner was about female academics. And she was telling her story, and she was telling the story of her research. And she said, so in 5 years' time, what I expect, I'll hope to have achieved, is to have mapped every cell in the body. And I thought, what? And I couldn't quite get the disjunction between sitting there in this room that probably hadn't changed in 200 years, listening to this person talking about the pace of knowledge and development in science that I couldn't even conceive of, actually. And then I thought, no, actually, they do go together. Because what there is here is a stability in that things, the things like food and procedures and traditions don't change too much, but the important things change. And you need to create the space. And actually, college dinners are part of Cambridge. Cambridge sees as part of innovation. You will sit down next to somebody you don't know, and you will start to talk about work, and you'll exchange ideas, and from that, new things will come. And that is actually a very central belief in Cambridge. So I think you're absolutely right. We need some stability. We're human beings, we can't cope with constant change. And policy, I'm afraid, is largely dictated by people who have the power. I know that's not that's too much to say. But they exert great influence. And you know, great academics like Stephen Ball have actually written about that and shown it and you know, shown the networks and so on and so forth, in London in particular. So yes, I think it is a huge danger.
I'll just come back to the main podium for this. Could I just thank on your behalf, Colleen, for what was a really stimulating and challenging and heartening presentation. I, for one, was trying to locate myself in the hype cycle and wondered, was I still in the trough of disillusionment or was I beginning to emerge onto the slope of enlightenment? And I hope you are with me on that journey as towards coffee and enlightenment. Thank you so much again, Colleen. I'm sorry we had to cut this short. Our time is up after 3:30, but Colleen is here until tomorrow lunchtime, so please take the opportunity to come and chat to her. I'm sure she'd be delighted to discuss further any of the ideas that she has presented in her keynote address. I just need to make some housekeeping announcements for you now. If you look at the program, you'll see that coffee awaits outside in the lobby area. Please do go and see Christina in the tent if you would like to volunteer to carry out or to engage in the research activity. She's just outside here. And then at 4:00, it's time for the first session of workshops. I'm being told to encourage you to go to the assigned workshop, so you should have signed up for a workshop. And if you're not sure or didn't put one down, you have been assigned to a workshop. If you're not sure which one that is, there should be a list on your table, in the center of your table. And if you're still not sure, please come and see Emer, who's up at the front here, and we'll be able to clarify that. The venue for the workshops is the first floor. They're either in meeting rooms 4, 5, or 6, but the full details are on the program, and they're all on the first floor. There is a second opportunity to take part in a workshop tomorrow morning, and I'm told that there is a bit more flexibility around the choice of the workshops for tomorrow morning. The workshops will start at 4:00. They should be over around 5:30, and then you have some free time, so please make the most of that. But come back down again for 7:00, for a drinks reception just outside here, and our report launch. We have 2 reports to launch this evening, and we're very much looking forward to that. So if you could be down here for 7:00 for the report launch, and then we'll move into this room, the Hamilton Suite, for the conference dinner around 8 p.m. I'm not sure, Colleen, if we're going to have any clowns at the conference dinner this evening, but perhaps after a couple of glasses of wine, who knows? And finally, because I won't have a chance to speak to you until then, tomorrow morning, breakfast is served not down here, but on the 13th floor. So if you come down here looking for breakfast, you may be sadly disappointed. It's on the 13th floor. And then the workshops, we're straight into workshops tomorrow morning at 9:30. Breakfast is served, I think, from 8 a.m. On the 13th floor. I think that's all the announcements I have to make. Thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy your coffee and the workshops to follow. Thank you.